Well, before I call our second case for the my notes tell me that some students from Whitehall are here. Is that the case? And if oh, very good. Very good. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here as part of our program of Court with Class, so they've had an opportunity to learn a little bit about the case that you're going to be arguing to us. They're not able to stay at noon, so we won't have a justice come down and talk with you unless your plans have changed at all. You have to let our marshal know. But my understanding is you have to leave before the argument is over. So we welcome you to hear this argument, and usually it's a very our second case is Town of Lincoln. Council, are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
Good morning. My name is Pete Reinhardt. I'm an attorney with the and I represent the Town of Lincoln in this case. The first issue I'd like to discuss is what is the meaning of WIS Stat Section 66.0711C. Specifically, can a town assert that the rules applicable not apply because the annexation is not an annexation, or is it precluded from doing so by 66.021711C?
Can I just back you up just a little bit so that I want to hear everything you have to say? This wasn't unanimous, right?
It was not a petition for direct.
So then you have to give certain notice by publication and otherwise, right? And they didn't do that. So when notice is given by publication, can other individuals object, or is it still the town that lodges the objection?
Can other residents of the town object?
Yeah, what's the purpose of the notice?
I don't know what the purpose of the notice is.
Who else can object besides the town? That's really my question.
Well, if you look at the case law, the residents of the town don't have standing to object. So who can object? The people who are part of the annexation property, annexation territory, or the town.
So if we were to reverse this and say start over, and they did it by the other provision, not unanimous consent, then we'd be in the exact same place we are now because the town is the only one that can object. Is that right?
We'd be in the same place, yes.
Okay.
Okay, so the only difference really between using subsection 2, which is what was alleged, is a notice provision that does not really result in anyone else being able to object to the annexation than the town who is currently objecting, correct?
Right. The real difference is what rights does a town have?
Okay, so what you're saying is that you have
if it's a direct annexation by unanimous approval,
yep,
arguably the rights are limited. If it's a direct annexation by one-half approval, we're talking about the two different...
Yes. Yeah.
And the rule of reason applies. All three components of the rule of reason, and everything's fair game.
Okay.
So it's a significant and important distinction, which is why the meaning of 66.02.17.11.
Test.
Well, if you remand it, it's still a direct, it's still a question of, so there still needs to be some interpretation.
Right. They could amend it. Just say not unanimous, right? And then you have the test being the broader ability. I mean, you'd be in the same place, except you'd have broader ability to challenge it.
Right, that is correct. Then on remand, if you were to say it's not unanimous, and because it's not unanimous, the restrictions of 11C don't apply, then it would be remanded, and then the trial court would have to look at whether or not the components of the rule of reason are.
Well, counsel, why would we remand? I mean, do we know? I don't know why you argue that we would remand it. It seems to me your argument is this is based on unanimous approval. There's not unanimous approval. Therefore, the petition is defective and none of the other requirements come into play. Why are you indicating remand?
That is not the argument we made. At the trial court, we said because it is not by unanimous approval, the three elements of the rule of reason apply.
Okay, what are you arguing here? Don't tell me what you're arguing. I'm interested in understanding your argument here.
I'm arguing here that we go with what the petition is, not what it's called. What the substance of the petition is, not what the form of the petition is. And if we do that, the court, the trial court, has to look at all three elements of the statute, which say language. Well, if we do that, the restrictions in the statute that are argued by the city do not apply. And let me just address that briefly, because the question really is, what does that language mean? Except as provided in sub 6 D2, no action on any grounds, whether procedural or test the validity of an annexation under sub 2. The town of Lincoln has never asserted in this case, which goes to your point, that the petition is invalid or void because it lacks unanimous approval. What the town of Lincoln has said is, because it's not an annexation by unanimous approval, a different set of rules apply to determine validity.
Right, but the
argued at the trial court that it's invalid because it didn't meet procedural substantive requirements. We could have, but we didn't, and we would have fallen into the trap of what the city of Whitehall.
But if it falls under the other statutory provision, the notice wasn't given and it goes away. I mean, right?
I'm sorry.
If we say that it's not unanimous and it falls under the other provision, notice was not provided, and therefore the petition would be dismissed, correct? I mean, they didn't follow the other provision where there's non-unanimity. So,
arguably,
right?
Arguably, yes.
Okay, so that's what you're arguing, it's not unanimous. It falls under 3A, which is direct annexation by one-half approval. Rest of that provision with respect to notice, the petition gets dismissed.
That's yes? Now, that, I understand what you're saying.
Well, is that what you're arguing or not?
No.
You're not?
No. Because
okay.
What I'm arguing or what we argued is the restrictions do not apply to the three elements of the rule of reason because it's not a petition for unanimous approval.
Why do you even get to the rule of reason if you don't follow? Where are you, is the question. You're saying you don't move directly to 3A, or you're just...
If you're not, well, it's a direct annexation, right?
Correct.
Property owners. There's two types of direct annex: unanimous approval and one-half approval. So and if it's not...
It's not unanimous. So we automatically go to that provision where there's no notice.
Right.
Okay. That's right. And really, that's what the questions, I think, of Justice Ziegler went to. What would the notice provide? Would there be people who could come and argue in addition to the town, and that's why you give a broader notice, but you're telling us no, that the town would just get to make different arguments. So essentially you're saying that the notice provision has a de minimis effect on this matter going forward, but has a big effect in whether you get to argue the rule of reason, correct?
Why? Why can't anyone else argue? I don't understand that piece at all. If you give notice to the people who are affected by this, don't they have a right to argue it? Isn't that part of the purpose of it?
I can't recall the name of the case. It was in the town residents don't have standing, and the language is they don't have a pecuniary. I can't recall the exact standing language, and there's several unpublished cases, too, that seem to say this.
Well, maybe not just general residents, but what about people directly affected by the annexation? You're saying nobody could challenge it except the...
They, didn't all the people except the railroad affected by the annexation sign the petition?
That is correct.
So they wouldn't be coming to us and, or any court and saying, oh, we want to argue this shouldn't happen, this shouldn't happen.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, so let's assume it's an annexation by one-half approval. Okay. Your question is, who can argue?
The other half?
The other half.
Okay, so it isn't de minimis. There is a purpose to the notice.
There's a distinction between people who are not part of the annexation territory.
So here the railroad could, in theory, argue that they don't want this annexation to happen.
Correct.
Because they didn't sign.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, you're asking us to construe the petition under sub 3, but... Everyone acknowledges it didn't comply with the statutory notice requirements. So I don't know how we could do that unless you're asking the court to just disregard sub 4, the notice requirements. They're mandatory.
So what you're saying is if we're right, the process should start over.
That's what it seems to be.
But if you take the city of Whitehall, they would say that's a procedural defect.
Well, unless you don't even get to that subsection because it's not unanimous. Isn't that what you're arguing? You don't even get under 11. You're not even there unless it's unanimous. It says under 11C that it's only met if it points you to the section for direct annexation for unanimous.
Council, is applying the rule of reason something that involves factual determinations by the circuit court, or is it something this court could decide as a matter of law? Well, that's not the answer to my question. Is it a fact or is it a law? We decide, we don't decide facts, we do decide law. So,
well, I think.
Or a legal question. It's a legal question. Okay, so if it's a legal question, are there facts in dispute that would need to be sorted out at the trial court level?
Well, that depends where you go. The whole issue of contiguity and how you determine boundaries are arbitrary. Because currently, the test is, we're talking about the first element of the rule reason, and contiguity, which relates to arbitrary. Currently, under the case law, the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals have said, well, if it's a gerrymandered, if it's crazy quilt, if it's shoestring, if it's strip or corridor, if it's balloon on a string, it doesn't pass muster on the first element of the rule of reason. The question is, how do you determine that? How do you determine if it's gerrymandered, crazy quilt, shoestring, strip on a board, strip or...
Well, those are all just labels
that are
put on an irregular annexation, correct?
And that is the problem. The case law says these things are not proper. You can't have them. But the case law doesn't tell us how do you determine if these things exist. What we're at now, if you look at the case law, is You look at the Town of Mount Pleasant case, and you look at the configuration there, and you compare it to the configuration at issue. And, of course, no one size fits all. They're all, every situation is going to be different, and there's just no guidance for the courts other than a visual subjective test. And that's why I stated in the brief it would be very helpful for the court to expand that test and look at what's the underlying purpose of the prohibition. The underlying purpose is we want to avoid boundaries that make it difficult to administer between the town and the municipality. And so if you were to combine, okay, let's look at the shape and size of dimensions, let's look at how this actually affects the administration of municipal services, and have a totality of circumstances test.
Well, it's a city, though, that's going to have to provide more services to these people, not the town. The town is going to be relieved of some of its past obligations if this annexation is upheld, correct?
That is correct, but it's not who's providing the services. The question is, does the crazy quilt pattern interfere with the effective administration of the service? Map, you have roads that are part in the city, part
right,
in the town.
Right, I see that.
You have an ambulance who's not going to know where it's going to go. You have snowplows.
Why are these considerations that the court is equipped to address?
I'm sorry.
Why are these considerations that the court is I don't know that we have the competence to decide what is efficient delivery method of services. Isn't that something that the city should figure out?
I can only state that the Town of Mount Pleasant case said the reason for this prohibition against arbitrary boundaries is because of the efficient administration of services. The Supreme Court is not equipped to make that determination. The trial court, maybe.
Well, I'm questioning whether any court is equipped to make that determination. When we say, if we were to say, look, we're going to strike this down because it looked inefficient to administer services, isn't that just kind of an outcome-based rationale for where we want to get? What are the judicial standards by which? Well, look, this configuration is actually in violation of somebody's rights, and therefore it's not appropriate. Who are we to say that this just doesn't look efficient, and so we're not going to allow it? Where would we get the authority to do that?
I go back to precedent.
Well, in what I'm trying to figure out is where'd Mount Pleasant get that from? And I can't figure that out from that case, and I can't figure out how we would administer such a standard. What are the rules that we would apply to figuring out this much administrative difficulty is too much, but that much?
Well, you would do it, I think, like you do in a number, you look at the totality of the circumstances.
Well, totality of circumstances just tells us the how would we analyze something like that?
Well, I suppose you would have to come up with some criteria to guide the trial court.
Were there any criteria in Mount Pleasant like that?
And that's the quandary here. The Town of Mount Pleasant case, as well as some prior. And as far as I can tell, that's the only place where the court addressed the reasoning or the rationale behind the first component of the reasoning. And I think there was a citation to other jurisdictions. That's what we're left with. And that's one of the reasons we're here, I think.
Counsel, the first issue stated in the petition for review and also as set forth in your is, under the circumstances here, is a town from which property is being annexed barred and precluded under 66-02-17-11C from asserting that the annexation petition is not, in fact, a petition for direct annexation by unanimous approval. Is that the issue you believe we are to address today?
It is one of the issues that I believe.
And what's the answer to that question? Is the town barred, under the applicable statute referenced, from asserting that the annexation petition is not, in fact, a petition for direct annexation by unanimous approval?
The answer to that question is no, because that's not what the statute says, first of all. And second of all, if you apply the rules of statutory construction.
Are you asserting that the petition filed here is not a petition for direct annexation by?
Apparently there's a disagreement, but I don't see any way around it not being a petition for direct annexation by unanimous approval. That requires all of the electors in the annexed territory to and all of the property owners. The railroad was a property owner. There's no question.
I'm a little bit unsettled because that issue sounds to me like you're raising the issue. Are you barred from asserting that this is a petition for unanimous approval? And indeed, the Towns Association brief characterizes the issue in this case just that way. But then you start out in saying, I'm really not arguing that, because this is really in under the law a petition for direct annexation by one-half approval.
Well, let me give you the stage of how it happens. So at some point, a petition is filed, and it's called a petition for direct annexation by unanimous approval. If it's labeled as such, the statutory procedure.
I know.
So the first time the town can assert any challenge is at the trial court. And that's what we did, and the trial court said, hey, you can't raise any issues about that because this is a direct annexation by unanimous approval.
Well, we've got to catch it someplace, and I'm not sure what you're.
Well, my argument is, has always been, that all three elements of the rule of reason apply.
On the stated first issue, what is your position? Is this a petition for annexation by unanimous approval?
It is not.
Right, well, because there are statutory criteria? Is that the that there are statutory criteria? Is that why you're concerned?
I may. Let me continue. So you're saying it is not. Then why is the first question framed, are we barred from arguing that? You're not even arguing.
Because that is the basis for the trial court's decision and for the Court of Appeals decision.
As you understand the trial court's decision, did they conclude that this was a petition for direct annexation by unanimous consent, even though it's agreed that all of the property owners did not sign the petition?
As I understand the trial court's decision, the trial court said because of subsection 11C.
Right, but they had to have assumed it was correctly labeled in order to get to 11C, correct?
I don't think so. I think it's that legal fiction. If you call it this, then you're precluded from raising these issues, and all you contiguity and county parallel.
Well, counsel, if I have a horse I want to sell you, and I label it a cow when I put it up for sale, and you buy it from me and pay me for it, and I give you the animal, do you have a horse or do you have a cow?
I agree with you.
Well, what is it? I don't know.
Maybe it's a mule. But you have a horse, obviously. So, and that's pretty much your argument to us. And then the lower courts made arguments and decisions based on agreeing that they could call it whatever they want, and because they called it that, that was the end of the discussion.
Well, that's exact. Well said. Better than I said, apparently. But I guess I have very little time left, but I wanted to address.
Can I just go back to one thing? So if notice were given and this were proceeding under the other section, the only entity other than the town that could object would be the railroad.
That's correct.
Okay. And the railroad knew about this?
That I don't know.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Although the notice could supply a usable function, just telling people who have standing to challenge the annexation, right? Because once an annexation like this is proposed, the city has to decide whether or not to do it. It's not automatic. The city makes a decision.
That is correct.
So if the notice goes out to more broadly, and people outside the annexation territory have noticed, they might object. They might have reasons why they don't want to see the annexation. And they'll run to the town when they have their public hearing. No, right?
Right.
And that's a useful function for the notice of hearing requirement to play, isn't it?
Correct.
And if that was not complied with here, shouldn't we dismiss the petition in its entirety so that it could be done? So that if there are other people in the town, they'd have an opportunity to address the city, make their view.
Yes. I think my time's up.
It is. It is. Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning.
My name is Ryan Steffes. I'm here today representing the city of Whitehall. I was hoping to start off talking about the statutory continuity. It's the more important issue in this case. But I'm going to start by addressing subsection 11C, given that that's where the focus of this argument has been. And I want to start by saying that Justice Dallet is exactly right. If this is truly an annexation petition under sub 3A, then it's just invalid. That's easy, because the petitioners did not comply with the notice requirements. They did not comply with the time requirements.
Why do they have to comply with notice and time if the petition by unanimous consent didn't have to have?
And that was exactly going to be my next point. This was never a petition under sub 3.
It wasn't a petition apparently under 2 as
well. Well, but it was. It was clear that it was intended to be a petition under sub 2 and that it was considered by the city as a petition under sub 2.
But is that subject to challenge? Right? Are we bound by the title on the petition, or can we look at whether the statutory requirement?
It's a question of who has the standing to make that challenge. The railroad company clearly did. In fact, the railroad company would have had 90 days to make that challenge. The town, however, did not have standing to make that challenge.
So how about if the town, if instead of doing what they did and saying, well, look, we're going to acknowledge that this was filed as petition for direct annexation by unanimous approval, and then we're going to ask whether we can challenge that. What if they just went to court and said, look, this is not under sub 2. This is under sub 3. And we're challenging it on that. They could do that, couldn't they?
The town could not, no.
Why not?
Because that's a challenge to the validity of the annexation. At
that point, it's a challenge to the annexation because it's not... It didn't fulfill the requirements of sub 3. And they can challenge that, right?
Oh, I misunderstood your question, yes. If it's an annexation under sub 3, then the town certainly had standing and the town would prevail for the reason
okay.
I noted.
So why isn't that the posture that the town said, well, look, we're going to give you the fact that you've put this title on the petition. It's an inactive doing, but we'll give you that, and then we're going to challenge whether you actually did do that, right? So you would say under that circumstance, which is the way it appears to have happened, they can't challenge that. But if they went to court and said, well, look, this is not under sub 3, then presumably the city would come back and say, well, you know, we did this under sub 2, under unanimous approval. There's posh. You didn't have unanimous approval, and they would win, right? So why? So what is the procedural distinction that you're trying to draw here that would preclude the town from making this challenge when, in fact, they have a good challenge, and it's clear.
The issue is, if you look at the language of sub 6D, which is referenced in 11C, it provides...
Which we only get to if, in fact, it is a...
Right, but it is.
Hang on a second. That's the title on it. Is the petition determined by the title attached to it or by the fact of what it actually is?
Well, I would say it's determined by the title. However, there is somebody who could come back and challenge that and say, oh, you titled it wrong, you didn't follow the procedure. But
so
that's
what,
not the town.
So one property owner could declare, I'm going to do a petition for direct annexation, and he includes property owned by 20 different people. He's the only one that signs it. He submits that to the city. That's going to be considered as a petition for direct annexation by unanimous?
Well, the city certainly wouldn't consider it that way under those facts. I think we need to be clear here that there's absolutely no evidence that the city knew or that the petitioners or that Whitehall Sand and Rail knew that the annexation petition excluded this railroad company's ownership interest in this narrow section of property.
But just by labeling it that way, that even though everybody understands on its face, that ain't what it is.
That's correct. If it's passed as an annexation under sub 2, the town is limited to two bases for challenging. Review is possible to determine whether the annexation violates any of the following. And there's a list. It includes two things. One of them is the requirement under sub 2 regarding the contiguity of the territory to be annexed with the annexing city or village. What's notably missing there is the ability to challenge the requirement under sub 2 that the petition was signed by all electors and property owners.
Right, but that's because that's how you get to sub 2, right? The way you get to sub 2 is you've got all the property owners that have signed on to the petition. So the town is saying, you haven't gotten to sub 2 yet because you didn't have, in fact, unanimous approval. So you can call it a horse, you can call it a cow, but in fact, it's one of them and not the other.
I think we're ships passing in the night here.
Yes, and I'm wondering why.
Because
what I'm looking for is an answer.
The ex ante question
is, what subdivision must this be considered? And there's nothing in the statute that says that the title is controlling on what it is. It just says that you can do an annexation by one of two means. You can do it by unanimous consent, or you can do it by one half. And so when we're looking at which one are we under, why do we care what somebody's under?
I think the reason we're somewhat talking past one another is because you're getting to the merits of the argument that this annexation didn't comply with the requirements of sub 2.
No,
and I'm saying we never...
What we're arguing about is the...
I think that's fair.
Yeah. So what you're saying is I'm in the door sub 2. Now you can't ask me... And I'm asking, wait a minute, how is it that we have to accept your position, just your bald statement that you got in the door? How come I can't look at whether you actually did get in the door properly?
Because I think the legislature precludes you from doing that.
Okay, tell me the exact language that precludes.
Okay. Under subsection 11C, it provides, except as provided in sub 2, D2, no action on any grounds, whether procedural or jurisdictional, to contest the validity of an annexation under sub 2 may be brought by any town.
Okay.
Now, and then when you go to 62...
Okay. Well, that's the DOA administration and all of that kind of stuff. But let's concentrate on 11C. So it says that unless you're going to challenge it under, you know, whatever the due... you don't get any procedural or jurisdictional challenge. That's the validity of an annexation under sub 2. X tells me, well, are we under sub 2? And the answer to that question is, well, we go to sub 2 and we find out what sub 2 is. Sub 2 by unanimous approval. And so when I'm asking whether we're under sub 2, that's dependent on the question of whether you actually had unanimous approval, right?
Unanimous approval is one requirement, not the only one.
But it is one.
It is one of them.
And it is dispositive if you don't have it.
But it's, again, this is a standing question.
Well, hang on a second. The answer to that is yes.
If the town...
It's dispositive. If you don't have it's dispositive. It can't be under sub 2.
If the town had standing to challenge whether that requirement was complied with.
Not looking at the standing question just yet. What I'm asking is it dispositive that if you do not have unanimous approval, then it's not a petition under sub 2?
Yes, if the person asserting that claim has a statutory right.
Yeah. I want to know what it actually is. Is it a petition under sub 2 if you don't have...
I think it is in this case. It is because there's nobody to challenge whether that requirement was complied with.
Question of standing, it's a question of what it is. You can call it, if you're selling a horse and it's actually a cow, it's still a cow regardless of what you call it, right? So if a petition for annexation, direct annexation by approval requires unanimous approval and you don't have it, then it ain't that creature, is it?
Again, it's not, but I don't think we ever get to that question. That's my position.
Well, and here's why you do get to that question. Because 11C says there is a limitation to contesting the validity of it. So the ex ante question we have to ask is this a petition under sub 2? And you just said it's not.
I think it was. The petition was under sub 2 and the annexation ordinance was passed.
What would preclude anyone, from filing under sub 2 if that would mean so long as you call it unanimous approval, even if you can preclude everyone from challenging whether it's unanimous approval?
Well, because the only entity
that... What would preclude anyone from not... Why wouldn't everyone file it as unanimous?
I think the city still has an obligation to consider whether it's unanimous. But the key point is that the town is not – there are other people besides the town who can challenge. So that you can't just willy-nilly have a petition that's – you call it unanimous when you know it's not, and then the city enacts an ordinance knowing it's not, because there are parties out there withstanding to challenge that. It just so happens that the town from which the territory is annexed is not one of those parties. And that's a legislative determination.
Okay, so what are the different things along the way?
Well, one other point I do want to make is that when these petitions are filed, a copy goes to the town. So if the town believes there's a defect, such as a missing signature, the town has an opportunity to tell the city, to tell the petitioners. And if they do, the city or the petitioners have a strong incentive to fix that defect because there are parties out there who would be able to challenge the annexation, even though it is not the town. And I'll note that in this case, not only is there no evidence that the city knew there was any defect, the town got the petition before the city ever acted on it. And there's no evidence that the town ever told the city, the petitioner, or Whitehall Sand and Rail that they thought there was a defect. If they had, the defect would have been corrected. Because it wasn't, there was a risk that the annexation could be overturned. But that risk was only that that railroad company would seek to overturn it. The risk was no longer that the town would seek to overturn it, because once the annexation ordinance was passed, then the statute says the town is limited to, the town is basically restricted from challenging annexation except in two narrow circumstances. And one of those actually does tie into the requirements of a sub 2, but it's the requirement of contiguity, not the requirement of notice or the petition of every elector or property owner is on it.
Does the railroad know? Did the railroad know before the property was annexed that this was pending?
I don't know. The record does not reveal the answer to that.
Okay.
Although I would say that the railroad in particular has no reason to care whether it's in the town of Lincoln or the city of Whitehall, because the railroad is almost all state and local regulation of railroads is precluded. So it's one party that, in all likelihood, would never challenge.
So, counsel, if the label of the petition is what controls, then wouldn't that also be equitable to say that that controls the town's challenge? So if the town could challenge this effectively, you know what, this was actually a petition for annexation under sub 3, not under sub 2. Court, we want a declaration that that is the case. Therefore, the petition is invalid. The court would say, well, is it true? Right? Is this under 3? And the court in that circumstance would say, well, let's take a look. And they look and they say, well, there was not unanimous approval, so it couldn't be under 2, so it must be under 3. You didn't follow the procedures under 3, town you went. Right? Anything wrong with that?
I just think the problem with that, and we're kind of going over this, is that I just don't think you ever get to that point because the town is not the party that can make that challenge.
Right. So let me just back up and we'll run this through. The town files its challenge with the court. Says, court, we are challenging this as being an unlawful sub 3. And presumably, the city would come back and say, that's because it's not under sub 3, it's under sub 2. Then the court would be tasked with determining who was correct about that, right?
Well, just by saying it's under 3A, that in itself is a challenge to the validity of the annexation, because as in this case, if it truly is under 3A, it's invalid.
Right, but his challenge is not precluded from challenging unless it is. So if they go in, and if we're talking about just labels controlling what our challenge is that this was not under sub 3. It's not a law. City responds and says, that's because it's under. And then the circuit court would have to answer, well, was it under sub 3 or was it under sub 2? Yeah?
I still think it's the town challenging the validity of the annexation.
What I hear you saying, which is a little bit, is the town had the opportunity to object to this, but it was before this time. It was when they got notice of it and the city was about to proceed. It isn't after everything is done to then challenge it on that basis court. Is that what you're saying? That they waived or forfeited the right to proceed and challenge it now?
Not a question.
They didn't challenge it when they received notice?
Yes, but it's not a question of forfeiture. It's an effect of the passage of that annexation order is that the instant that annexation ordinance is passed under sub 2, whether it was procedurally deficient or not, the town has only two bases to challenge that annexation. Other people may have other bases, but under subsection 11C, the town only has two bases. That's it. And that's what the...
Could the railroad come into court and challenge it?
The railroad would have 90 days. Under subsection 11A, the railroad in this case would have been the one party who had standing. They had 90 days to make that challenge. They didn't do so. And, of course, the town certainly could have advised the railroad of that defect whenever the town discovered it, even if it was after the annexation petition.
Count, are you finished?
Yep, thanks.
It appears that you do, but let's clarify the record. Do you concede that the petition here is not unanimous?
Yes, for purposes of today, I do. There's a little bit of uncertainty in where exactly the railroad ownership. It's intermittent between railroad ownership and railroad right-of-way. I do think there's potentially some unclarity there. But for the purposes of today, yes, I assume that the railroad company was the property owner and did not sign.
So the petition is not unanimous. That's your concession.
Correct. If you get to the merits of that challenge, we lose.
I understood from your briefing that you also said that even though it is not unanimous, that the procedural irregularity is de minimis.
Yeah, and that gets to the point of who is the missing property owner. It's a property owner who owns a very narrow sliver of land, and it happens to be a railroad company who I can't think of any conceivable interest they would have in caring whether this property was in the town of Lincoln or the city of Whitehall, because neither the town, the county, nor the city can really regulate them in any way.
If the court determined that this petition was not a unanimous petition and is under sub 2, not 3, is your argument that the court would have to remand to determine if that procedural irregularity?
I think that would be right, because I do think that is legitimate given the particular facts of this case and the nature of the property apparently missing.
Why couldn't we just as a matter of law, I want to say logic, but also law, it isn't unanimous because one property and we can say that as a matter of law. Why can't we just?
Again, that gets to the merits of the argument. It bypasses the question of whether the town is a party that has a legal right to make that challenge.
And so the essence seems to be, is there a threshold question here? And is the threshold question a determination of whether this properly a unanimous petition, filed as a unanimous annexation petition?
I would say this case is certainly not about whether there's a signature missing on the annexation petition. This case is about whether the town has standing to challenge whether there is a signature missing from the annexation.
Counsel, I understood your argument a little better after you answered. Did the town object too late? In other words, this petition has looked like this petition has looked since it was filed. And there was a time when the town could have said what they're saying here. They could have gotten to the merits of whether the statute was complied with. But once they waited until after the annexation ordinance was enacted, they lost that right. Is that what you're saying to us?
That's exactly right. That's the effect of subsection and subsection 60.
And what's the logic behind that?
First off, I think there's a sense to say that we shouldn't be arguing whether that's good policy or bad. That's the legislature's prerogative. But I do think there is a basis for greatly limiting town standing. And the reason is that towns are very prone to challenge annexations. You look through the table of authorities.
Let me just ask you this. Should there come a time when, like, you know, the things that they do with a piece of property, or sometime in the future gets undone because a signature was missed?
Well, and that's another issue here. This territory has been part of the city of Whitehall for 3.5 years now.
I have a question. Why, and I'm not following the logic here. If you're calling it a unanimous annexation, how do you say that the town should have challenged it earlier? The town can't challenge it under what you're arguing. So why does it matter at what point in time it is?
Well, there was maybe a question of whether the town could have filed an action before the city acted on the petition. That's not really what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is that nobody knew. The city didn't know. The petitioners didn't know. Whitehall Sand and Rail didn't know that there was effectively this error in the petition.
Yet you're still arguing the town should have challenged it earlier and they lost their opportunity?
Well,
that doesn't make sense.
But I think it does, because the petition is filed with the town. At that point, the town can scour that petition any way it wants to say, is there something defective with this petition?
Okay, but they can't challenge it, because you already said
it's unanimous.
They can't. You're saying they can't even make a challenge to whether it's unanimous or not. If you've labeled that petition unanimous, they can't come into court and say it's not because the railroad's missing. Let's say they would have found this out.
Under your argument, they can't argue that.
Let's set aside whether they can go into court. What they certainly could have done was tell the city.
Okay, but we're operating under statutes in court. We're not talking about
people can pick up the phone all the time. They usually don't come to court if they pick up the phone, right?
And there is a question, and I think the answer isn't obvious. Would the town have had standing to file a declaratory judgment before the annexation petition before the annexation ordinance was enacted? That's the key event here, is the enactment of that ordinance. That's when subsection 11C kicks in and limits the town's standing.
Right. So if they can't file, if the town can't file their legal challenge until the annexation ordinance is passed, then what you said before doesn't really make any difference, right? Because you were saying, well, they waited too long. They waited until the annexation ordinance was. It was not right before then, right? They couldn't have filed before that point, because the town might not have adopted the ordinance.
I think the practical consideration was that if the town, they would have changed the petition.
Different question. The question is one of standing, right? And you say no standing. They should have. Well, there was no challenge before. If that came to us, we would say it's not ripe. You filed this before the city adopted the ordinance. The city would have done that or not. And we'd say, you got to wait until the ordinance gets adopted. That's
why I referenced the declaratory judgment action. Analysis is a bit, I think we're getting off track here, but the ripeness analysis is a bit different in a declaratory judgment. You can't anticipate a dispute, and the court can step in and resolve. As a practical matter, it would never get to that point.
Under a declaratory judgment statute, there has to be a present dispute. You can do it before the harm accrues, but there does have to be a case of controversy before you can file the declaratory judgment action.
I think we're getting off track a bit, because I think you just never get to that. Because once the city knows there's a procedural deficiency, first off, I think it has an obligation to simply comply with the statute. But even apart from that, even if it had bad motives, even if the petitioners had bad motives, even if they intended to not apply the statute, once they're given notice of the defect, they have an incredible incentive to fix that defect, because their fear isn't that the town is going to challenge it. Their fear is that another party who has standing will challenge it.
The property owner, right?
Property owner who didn't sign.
And so what you're saying to us is we have to interpret two, not just the one that gives us the criteria to say whether or not this petition was a petition for direct annexation, but also to look at the fact that subsection 11 doesn't arise until after the annexation has occurred, and the town had the petition way before then, so the town certainly put a voice in objection one way or the other, and they were silent.
That's exactly right. I think that's correct. Our position is the result of this issue is dictated by the plain language of 11C, and the key event is the passage of that annexation ordinance. And then the legislature has determined the town simply doesn't have standing to challenge the validity of that ordinance, except for those two express reasons. And one of them actually is whether it complied with sub 2, but it's whether it complied with the contiguity requirement in sub 2. The legislature certainly could have added to that list, and perhaps after this case they will add to that list, to say that the third thing you can challenge is whether you complied with this other requirement under sub 2, the requirement that every elector and property. But as the statute is written today, the town simply doesn't have that right.
So it's not that the town is without recourse. It's just that once the annexation is complete, the town finds itself under 11C.
Annexation is a statutory process, and the legislature has determined, for good or for ill, that towns should be extremely limited in challenging annexations. And for this type of annexation, they can challenge whether one requirement of sub 2 was met. But it's not the requirement we're here talking about. It's the contiguity requirement, the one I was hoping we might talk about today, but because I think it is an interesting issue. But no, the town simply doesn't have a standing.
Well, why don't you do that really quick, because your light is on, and tell us why this annexation is contiguous.
Well, and that just gets to this court giving contiguous its common meaning, which I think is the proper thing to do. The only basis for not doing that would be this court's decision in Mount Pleasant. But as laid out in our brief, the reasoning of Mount Pleasant, or at least the part where the court says statutory contiguity is just the equivalent of reasoning, I think that reasoning has been eroded, albeit sub silentio, over the past 47 years, starting actually just 8 years after Mount Pleasant was decided, when the court decided Town of Lyons, which was a case where not only did the annexation create town islands, which at the time was not yet prohibited by statute, the annexed territory didn't even touch existing city territory. Yet this court in that case held that there was contiguity and held that there was compliance with the rule of reason. And the way it went about doing that, in my opinion, cannot be squared with Mount Pleasant, because the court clearly did not say that statutory contiguity is just the equivalent. It treated them as separate and distinct inquiries, and then it even went farther and said the first prong of the rule of reason doesn't even apply to direct annexations, where, of course, the statutory contiguity requirement would. And I
but
note that.
What are the prongs of the rule of reason? Cases refer to it. They never describe it. They say there are three elements and they don't give it.
I see my light is on.
You can answer the question, yes.
The first element, which I think the parties agree is the only one that could even conceivably come into play in this case. That may not. The first element is whether there are inclusions or exclusions that establish arbitrariness. And I think that gets back to a case that predates Mount Pleasant, which is the Town of Fond du Lac case, where you had an annexation that created a town island. And the reason it did create that town island was because there happened to be electors in that town island who opposed the annexation. Thank you.
Did you want to finish answering the question of Justice Abrahamson? She wanted to know what were the parts. You told us the first part, but I bet you'd like to know the rest.
Sure. I may have to refer to my brief.
That's all right.
To
go
answer.
Right ahead.
The second element has to do with whether there is a purpose for annexing the territory. And the third element is sort of a catch-all. Was there any other abuse of discretion in passing? Did the city in some other way abuse its discretion? I can't find the exact site, but I know that those are the three elements.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Just just to supplement, I think the second element is really relates to reasonable present or future need for the annexation. So it's a needs-based test on the second element, and the third element is whether or not it's arbitrary based on other factors. Mm-hmm. I want to address several things. Attorney Steffes is right. The legislature has said if it is a direct annexation by unanimous consent, that one situation, we're going to give very special rights, but it has to meet the requirements of being.
Why didn't the town object when you got?
I don't know the answer to that because I wasn't involved at that point. But I do think it's dangerous to impose some obligation on the town that's not set forth anywhere in the statute to make some objection, which they don't have any legal right to actually do.
Are there any limits on when you can come back? Can you come back 10 years later and say, you know, that annexation, I think, in this corner of the property?
Are we talking about what type of annexation are we talking about?
Unanimous. Just say it all proceeded, it's been going fine. Could you come back 10 years later and say, hey, by the way, City, I know you did all those improvements there, but we're taking that back because you missed this?
I think there would be any number of, I hate to say it, but waiver or latches that would preclude somebody from doing that.
So,
is there a time period in the statute that you would have to raise that objection? The answer to that is, I think you'd have to go, if it's actually an annexation, fall after the DOA review.
Okay, I'm just trying to think as a practical matter. When you're buying a home, you want to know, am I buying in the city? Am I buying in the town? Law enforcement and other entities need to plan for, are they providing? You have increased expenses. You have different tax situations. You have a lot that goes on. A year later, the town decides to challenge it. Guess what? You bought in the town.
The answer to your question is yes, I think there has to be some.
But where is it if the statute doesn't mean what it says?
Wouldn't that be in Chapter 893, Council?
Probably. You'd have to ascertain what statute of limitations is applicable.
Yeah. A lot of these planning and zoning and those kinds of cases, though, where you're dealing with these issues, they're designed to have people lodge their objections early in the process so you know what you're dealing with. You're not later painting stripes on a donkey calling it a zebra, right? You try to figure it out early so you can fix the problems before landowners and people end up in a situation where they're being duped down a path of development and, oops, we should have done this earlier to let you know that's not going to work. Right? I mean, the logic of all this kind of stuff is
to let people know what's going to happen to this land.
Agreed.
And have people object so that then people can proceed to know what it is. And when they develop property or when they, so there has to be a limit other than maybe sort of an arbitrary, gosh, I guess 10 years is too long, but 3.5 years.
There has to be a limit. I would note in this particular, the town timely asserted its objections. And I would also note that why is it the town's obligation? The city is the one approving it and the burden is not on the town to say, hey, there's a missing signature here. That's on the annexation petitioners.
Yeah, but there comes a point when it's not the town's property. It's the city's.
True.
Well, it might be as short as 90 days under 893.
That sounds right. Thank you. The other factual issue I just say, well, there's two things. White House Sand and Rail was informed by that there was a missing signature. That occurred after the annexation. That's in the record. It was on May 5th. No action was taken in response to that. And finally, I didn't really understand what was being alluded to early on in the questioning about, well, if this is a direct, if this is not therefore, this court can, as a matter of law, say, that it is dismissed. I get it. I understand your point. I agree with your point there. That if it was an annexation by one-half approval, notice didn't go out. It's defective. It needs to be dismissed. So I apologize for not catching that earlier. As I look at the notice, I understand your argument, and I agree with your argument that remand.
We're not making the argument. It's just, did you ever make
that as a matter of law could be the Supreme Court could make the decision and say the is void, invalid? Yeah. I did not make that argument.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for a very, very interesting argument. I can tell from the responses of counsel, but you know. What happens when you bring it up here? You get seven people a little bit differently. The court is going to adjourn. I could come and talk to the students for a little bit if you have 10 minutes before you have to leave. Or if you want to get on your bus and hit the road, that's okay. We are adjourned.